It's not just a game, it's not just a grass. Lawn Solutions Australia is the exclusive home of Australia's best sports turf varieties. For the world's best grasses like Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda and Sir Grange Zoysia, contact Lawn Solutions Australia at lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au. Hello and welcome to episode 104 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast from Golf Australia magazine exploring the myriad reasons people from all walks of life get so hooked on this game. Rod Murray's my name, and joining me on the line from his base in Scotland is my colleague John Huggan, who's delivered some fascinating insights from some of the Ryder Cup's most illustrious figures over the past few weeks. This week we've got the last in that series, and while the Cup was decided last week in Rome, the level of interest has barely waned as focus shifts to the next instalment in New York in 2025. Huggy, we saw another fascinating event last week in Rome. It got me thinking about the role of some of the players with lesser profile in these events, and that turned my mind to today's guest, Ollie Wilson. He doesn't have the standing in the game of a Colin Montgomery or a Rory McIlroy, but my goodness, what an interesting talker and thinker he is.
Yeah, he kind of goes under the radar. He's one of the nicest people out there on the European Tour.
DP World Tour.
He's had a he's had a very interesting career in the sense that no one has gone up and down and down and up more than Ollie has over the years. I mean, he's had an incredible roller coaster ride, and he's won big tournaments. He's lost his card. I mean, he's done everything. He played in the Ryder Cup. He's done just about everything you can do as a professional, both good and bad.
Often in the space of a year, he played on the 2008 Ryder Cup team at Valhalla. I think he lost his card the following year from the DP or European Tour. So there's did you talk much about that? I haven't listened to the whole interview yet. I'm in the midst of editing it. What was the nature of the conversation? I did grab about the Ryder Cup for last week's show to play at the end. What was the bulk of the conversation, though?
Well, yeah, definitely. You know, we talked about how, you know, I tell you what, if you go to any tour event where Ollie's there, you'll inevitably find him on the range working away on something. I mean, to the point where I think it almost hurt himself. He gets into it too deep. Mm-hmm. There's too much fiddling around, too many changes, all that kind of thing. I mean, I'm maybe speaking out of school a little bit. He might not agree completely with that, but there's definitely been an awful lot of thought gone into his game, almost to the point where it's too much. You know, you can overthink everything. Yeah. Certainly you can overthink golf. Everybody knows when you're standing over the ball, the best thought is no thought.
Good luck with that.
I'm not sure Ollie's reached that point very often, but at the top of his game, I mean, he's capable of winning just about any tournament on the tour, but as I say, he's gone up and down from that quite a lot. The first time I ever saw him was he was actually playing for the GB&I Walker Cup team in 2003 at Ganton, and he looked like the best player in the GB&I team at that point. He's had a successful career. I mean, as I say, he's won events, and he played in the Ryder Cup in 2008 under Faldo. We talked a little bit about that. I give him and the rest of his teammates in that event huge credit, because they've never ever really thrown Faldo under the bus, which I think they very well could have done. I think the whole week was a bit of a catastrophe from start to finish in many ways, but the players they've stuck by him to an extent. I mean, I think Sergio came closest to telling the truth about what went on, but the rest of them, yeah, good on them. They've stuck by the captain. They've followed that principle, if you like.
Loose lips sink ships, Huggy, and there was no Mickelson for Faldo's Watson in that instance. And, of course, out of that comes, I'm reminded of Richard Gillis's book, The Captain Myth. Of course, what came out of the 2008 Ryder Cup was that Paul Azinger was a genius because he came up with the pod system, which may or may not be true, but there were certainly things happening on the other side which didn't hurt his team's chances, you would think.
Yeah. You're a genius if you win, and you're an idiot if you lose in the Ryder Cup. I mean, look at the way that Luke Donald has been hailed. And I'm sure he did a very good job and deserves a lot of credit, but the usual formula prevailed in the Ryder Cup last week. The three best players in the European team all played very well and won lots of points, and If that happens, you're going to win. It's as simple as that.
And conversely, of course, the three of the better players on the US side really struggled. 9-7, Koepka and Scheffler? Who could have predicted that? You couldn't have got odds
on that. Well, exactly.
That's just a staggering. Yeah. Yeah, let's not date the podcast too much by talking about about that. Ollie wouldn't be the first person in this game to fall victim to tinkering to the point of harm, would he?
No, and as I say, he's a good talker.
He really is.
Something of a media career in that he's been on Radio 5 Live. I've used him at Opens and Ryder Cups, I think. And he's an intelligent lad. And hopefully that'll come across in the podcast. I basically sat back and let him get on with it, to be honest.
Which is what the best interviewers do, Huggy. It does come across well. As I said, I'm partway through it and I'm really enjoying it. He's a fascinating thinker. Let's let the listeners have a listen to it. Thank you for joining us for a bit of a preview today.
My pleasure.
Okay, here we go with the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time is one of my favourite people in golf. I can say that without fear of contradiction. Ollie Wilson, Ryder Cup player, multiple European Tour winner. What was and is the thing about golf for you?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on. Yeah. The thing about golf for me is, I mean, it sounds a bit corny, but it's like the journey of it all. I'm addicted to the process of just trying to get better every day. And I think over the years, it's expanded from golf and just trying to be better at golf to then like understanding how many aspects play a part in your golf. So it like suddenly sort of takes over your life of this process of just trying to be better. And to me, that's the whole thing. I'm really lucky that that's how it is. I think a lot of athletes probably feel the same. A lot of people would feel the same. But for me, particularly, the vehicle is golf and just trying to get better all the time. And it gives me something to really focus in and get absorbed into. And on one side, there's the rewards of doing it well and playing great golf, and it sort of culminates in good golf. So you get the rewards through that. But then as you move on through life and the years tick by pretty quickly, I think you get the rewards through that and family and trying to figure things out and what's actually important. So that's why I think golf's so amazing. It's we're just really lucky to play it. It creates so many relationships and travel the world, see some amazing places.
It's not a bad life if you're good at it.
It's not. It's, you know, it's incredibly competitive. There's so many people out there trying to do it. And what's funny about being good at golf is it's not really about how good you are at golf. It's about how you put it all together and matching it up and figuring things out for yourself. So, it's amazing. There's so many things about golf, but I think the whole journey of it all for me is what makes it so special.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the journey. I mean, I must admit that every time I look up at a tournament, you're on the range working away on something. And you've had varying success, shall we say, on the journey. Your career has gone up and down more than most.
It has been a roller coaster, I'll give you that.
Yeah. Does that surprise you? I mean, for a long time, when up to sort of Ryder Cup and a little bit beyond, it was all good. Everything, your upper trajectory, and then it dipped, then it came up again, then it dipped again, and then up again. So what's the difference between when you're doing it right and when you're not doing it right?
I mean, it's mad. Like, my career is just absolute madness. And I would have given up a long time ago if I hadn't had the success early on, because I wouldn't probably believe that I could do it. Yeah. But because I'd had that success, I knew it was always there, and I knew what was holding me back. So I just think, you know, when I turned pro, I had... Jamie Elson was my college roommate, and he was my inspiration. He was doing everything a year ahead of me. And so when he sort of made me think about succeeding at a different level. And then I got on tour, and I just tried, my only goal was to get better every year. Even if it was one place on the order of merit, that's the only thing that mattered. And I kept improving. And suddenly, like 4 years later, I'm on the Ryder Cup. Then the following year, I had my best year. Everything was going great. And then I made I'd have made really good decisions those first 4 or 5 years as a pro.
For example?
Just in terms of management group, who I had around me, my coach, just creating the perfect environment for me to keep improving. And I never thought I could ever get to that level. I always thought that journeyman pro was the best I could get to. And
even after the Ryder Cup?
No, before that. Right. And so, but then I kept improving, and then suddenly I'm like, hang on a minute, I'm, you know, top 50 in the world, yeah. Ryder Cup. I'm like, wow, like I never even thought of that. And then it started to, 2009 was my best year, really starting to break into the sort of upper echelon of golf, getting right around the top 30 in the world. And then I made the worst decision of my career, which was to turn down my PGA Tour card because of the Ryder Cup. I wanted to stay and be in Europe and play in Europe and try and qualify for the team again. And the way things would set up with the players playing in the US and Europe, I thought that that was my best opportunity. And then it was just, it's a funny thing, you know, little things, little catalysts, but I broke my wrist, then I got ill. And during that process, I wasn't, well, during the, when I got ill, I didn't realize I was ill, started to play poorly, changed coaches, and it was just a downward spiral, and it went, it fell off a cliff fast. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was awful in
2013. Well, within 3 or 4 years of being in the Ryder Cup, you'd lost your card.
So 2009 was my best year, and then 2010 was okay, but I remember feeling like it was terrible. I can't remember where I finished, 40th or something on the order of merit, and it felt like it was the end of the world. Which is funny in itself. But then after that, it just got worse. And that's, like I said, a few things off course impacted the progress I was making, and just had no answers. And then suddenly I built this really good environment, and then suddenly this is all gone. And I didn't have people around me to help navigate that, really.
What were the bad shots? And what was making the difference between shooting 68 and 73, whatever?
Well, when I got ill, I was fatigued. I was really tired all the time, and I didn't know what was going on. And I just don't know. I didn't know what it was. And I just started to practice more and more because I wasn't playing well, but I was tired.
Sounds like you.
Yes. And it was obviously clearly the wrong thing to do. And I just got worse and worse. And then I wasn't playing that bad at that time. But what happened was when I lost my card and on a challenge shot, I was just like, suddenly I'm all alone. You know, I've always had a coach with me. And I'd gone from having, like I said, good people around me to really not having anyone around me. And I really struggled and my swing got worse. And I just started to drive it really badly. And it was like, you couldn't compete doing it. I couldn't keep it on the planet.
I remember that, yeah.
So 2013, I was terrible. And then 2014, I was pretty bad, and that was really rock bottom, and I was looking like giving it up. And then I started to make some better decisions, and I went and Rich Hill, my caddy that I'd had for 7 years through most of my success, reached out to me. He was caddying for Robert Rock, and said, "Look, let Rob have a quick look." I did, and 2 weeks later, I won the Dunhill. So things changed fast, and I know what I'm capable of. I've just never felt like I've had the technique to do it, and I've always been fighting it. And, you know, people always have their own opinions, but I think people around me know, understand what the problems have been. But, you know, that's one of the things I'm most proud of kind of battling through that and coming back. And, you know, I had to go to hit and drive off the deck for a few years just to get it in play.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, well, I can't hit it off a tee. I just need to get it on around the fairway and I can do the rest. So I did that, and then I won a couple of times on Challenge Tour and got my card back, and then had a good year in 2019, I think, 4 top fives. But I was hitting driver off the deck, and as well as I did that year, it just didn't...
Well, you're making it harder for yourself.
I just didn't enjoy doing it, because I don't want to play golf and not compete and not be able to compete in big tournaments. And I felt like doing that at that stage was not conducive to that. I was just kind of... getting it around, which is, you know, part of the goal. But I wanted to be able to compete. So I, you know, a few years ago, I decided that's it. I'm done with that. I'm going to tee it up and become a good driver of the golf ball. And that's been a process that I'm still working through. But as one of the big things about the Belfry the other week was how well I drove it around that golf course meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
And to hit the tee shots I did down the stretch meant a lot to me. So, you know, I'm getting there. But there's been a lot of ups and downs in those smaller periods as well. Yeah. I'm trying to figure that process out, really.
We're kind of doing this in the wrong order, but we'll delve into this a bit since you bring it up. I mean, how hard was it mentally? I mean, you've been talking mostly physically in your swing technique and the rest of it there, but there must have been some low moments. And how did your ego deal with being on the Challenge Tour after playing in the Ryder Cup? I mean, that must have been difficult.
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, you go through a whole process of, you know, I think I've always been relatively well grounded, but that will ground you in a hurry when you've gone from playing majors and world events and suddenly you're playing Challenge Tour and pulling a trolley around and you can't make the cuts.
You were actually doing that.
Yeah. I remember 2013, I was sat in my hotel room in Austria and that was rock bottom. I was in tears. I played earlier and I'd hit maybe 8 tee shots in the first 4 holes. And I was already 8 over, you know, tournament. It's after 4 holes, my tournament's done.
Yeah.
And, that was the low point, but you know, you just got to keep digging in and trying to, like I said, you can't do this on your own. This job is so lonely and there's so many aspects to it that you can't do it on your own. And hence why no one does do it on their own.
Yeah.
And you need people around you just to chat to, just to talk to. I'm very lucky. I've got an amazing wife. She's always very supportive of me, whatever I want to do. But also the people that I've had helping me, coaches at different times, they've all been good people. And just enough to kind of, you know, stay positive. Let's break things down one by one. This is where we're at. Let's be honest about it. Right, next week we're going to try and just improve just a little bit. Mm. Let's not think about cuts. Let's just a little bit better. And just keep working through it, and that's all you can do. But, you know, those days are long gone. You know, the golf I've been playing the last few years has been a million times better than that. Mm. Nowhere near where I want it, but a million times better. And now I'm playing the golf. You know, the results aren't what I want at the moment, but the quality of my golf is so much better, and I know that it's going the right direction. So it's exciting, but you know, that's one of the things. I think you learn so many lessons through golf that, I guess the biggest lesson I've learned is, you know, when you're playing well, you're invincible and you trust your instincts and nobody's going to sway you. And we don't always make the right decisions, but we're all stubborn as professional golfers. And I think you have to be, but you learn to trust your instincts. And when you start playing bad, certainly for me, in my experiences, I started to not trust my intuition and my experience and my knowledge. And I was needed verification from other people. And that's the worst thing you can do because they don't know. Yeah. And they're, you know, they see in a snapshot of your game, but they don't know everything that's going on. Mm. And that's when you can take control of things and try and navigate, but you still need a little bit of nudging here and there.
Is it like the old cliche of, you know, you play golf as a kid and then you grow up and you play as an adult, but then you spend all your time trying to get back to playing like you did when you were a kid?
Pretty much.
Is that kind of where you were?
Yeah. I mean, I think the problem that I've had is when I was having most of my success, I didn't know. Well, I knew what I was doing. It was so clear. The clarity I had on what I was working on, my swing, my short game, everything was just like, well, I'll just do this.
Mm.
And I didn't have much knowledge. So there's no knowledge in there to draw upon. And when things aren't working, it's not like, oh, I've got these options to go to. It's like, well, I've just got to keep doing this more. And it was frustrating. And there was a reason that I changed coaches back in 08 and 09, because I wasn't hitting the ball how I needed to hit it to improve. But, you know, you take one thing away and you add something and you lose something else. So
you change one thing, everything changes.
Exactly. And that was, but when I look back at it, you know, the decisions you make can be really big. And maybe I could have handled things better and instead of just changing coach, tried to work with them and try and figure that out. But I didn't. So you... and then when you are struggling, you go and see someone and you trust them because you're putting your career in their hands. But when you trust other coaches, it's just their opinion. And I been to see so many people and they were giving their opinion and I couldn't do what they were asking me to do. And I kind of felt like it wasn't the right thing, but I wasn't trusting my own opinion.
It sounds like too much information.
Well, and then so then on top of that, it's like, well, these guys aren't helping me. I'm not learning. I'm not getting better. And it's just an opinion. Let's go to facts. Let's go science. Let's go force plates, biomechanics. Like, this is fact. Yeah. And then once you go down that route, you realize it's not fact. That's just someone's opinion on the data.
Yeah.
And usually that's more scientific and it's nothing to do with playing golf. Mm-hmm. So, but the problem is then you have all this information in your head. It's like, oh my God, like where, like I'm not playing how I want. All right, this is not quite right. And now I've got like four different options to fix that little bit. And then once it's in your head, it's in your head.
Man, you've been down a few rabbit holes.
I've learned an incredible amount and I've got a lot of knowledge about playing and the golf swing. And
have you got too much though?
Yeah, I've got too much, but I think I'm doing a really good job more recent times of filtering all that out and getting the clarity. And I know when I play my best golf, I've got 100% clarity on what I'm working on, what I'm doing, and there's no other thoughts, and that's it. And that's what I'm working on all the time. I feel like I've got a pretty good blueprint for what I need to work on. But it's been tough. You know, my fundamental movement patterns are not, they're not Rory. You know, there's issues in there,
yeah.
And you're kind of always fighting that, but that's fine. Most of us are, and even guys like Rory, you know, we look at him and play and see how well he hits it, but he's fighting stuff. Yeah. It's just different levels. So I think I've kind of done a good job of navigating all that now and getting that behind me and trying to get rid of the noise and just staying focused on what I'm doing and what works and hopefully getting closer after 20 years of being on tour to understanding what's right for me and then just carrying on playing.
Is the hardest part physical or mental when you're down and getting back up? Because it sounds you were close to walking away, it sounds like.
Oh, I was there. I mean, I'm pretty sure we've talked about that before. Like 2014, if I was going to Q School and I only just took the invite into the Dunhill because I wanted to go and actually have a bit of fun. Mm. And I thought guaranteed three rounds at the Dunhill was better than two rounds on the Challenge Tour in Italy before Q School.
Right.
That was my decision.
Wow.
So that's where I was at thinking. That's my level of thinking. And then I've got Q School. And if Q School doesn't go, that's me. I can't keep playing like that.
Yeah.
And then I won.
I mean, how can I put that? How shocking was that to you? Because we were all people who observed the tour as long as certainly I had, and watched you, I couldn't believe it. It came out of nowhere, literally.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you'd have said to me I was going to win the Dunhill at any stage in the year before that, I would have, told you you're a lunatic. Yeah. But this is the thing about golf and trusting your instinct and your I know what I'm capable of. I truly believe I'm capable of winning any tournament in the world. Against any field when I have my game.
Yeah.
And that's been my issue, is just having my game more consistently.
So what did that feel like then? When you suddenly realized, oh my goodness, I could win this. Or at least you were going to get a very large check.
Well, I think that's what one of my strengths is. When I'm in the mix, I'm very good at taking one shot at a time and just like literally, right, we're on the tee. All we've got to do is get it on the fairway.
Yeah.
We've got to get it here. Right, let's get it at this position. Right, we're on the green. Let's try and hold it.
It's the classic one shot at a time.
One shot at a time. And I that's, for me, how I've always put my best scores together and my best results. And if you're thinking about anything else, in my experience, it's hard to do. It was unbelievable, hence why it was so emotional. I'd gone from trying to make... Well, I was gone from trying to just play three decent rounds to build some momentum to trying to make the cut to suddenly, well, let's try and make a bit of money here, middle of the pack.
Yeah.
But I'm leading by three going into the last round. I'm like, well, okay, all I've got to do here is just hang in there and I'm going to have a good week.
Yeah.
And then nine holes in, I'm struggling a little bit, but playing all right. Missed a few short putts. But then things just kicked in. Your experience and your instincts, and you're like, hang on a minute. You don't get many chances to win tournaments. And I've certainly not had any recently.
No.
And so let's just dig in here. And I, a few of my best results have been when I've kind of just formulated a plan mid-round and go, okay, well, this, you know, par five's to come, birdie chance, right, birdie those, par the rest, you're going to have a great week. And, yeah, it's funny, like,
it's kind of a simple game, but incredibly complicated.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, how simple is that? Yeah. But you've got to go and execute it. But when you get into that kind of mindset, it seems to be like you can do it and you're just so locked in on it. And I made a couple of birdies around the turn and suddenly I'm right in it and you just, you know, got to take my chance. You cannot give this up. You don't get these chances. And I won, you know, at that time I hadn't won.
Yeah.
So you're thinking about winning, but you know, you're just thinking about one shot at a time. When it's time to hit the shot, you're just so immersed in the shot and that's what you have to be. So coming down the stretch, obviously, I knew. And this is an amazing thing about golf and people's opinions on it is, bearing in mind how low I was on confidence. I mean, I had no confidence, and I went and won at the Dunhill because my technique was good. And this is a debate that lots of people will want to weigh in on. But in my opinion and my experience and talking to other golfers, when your technique's good, your mental game is good, because even though you'll still have those thoughts, I don't know what everyone else does, but I still had those thoughts, the bad thoughts, they're out of bounds on 14 and 17 and like road hole, like, oh my God, 18 is like the widest fairway in the world, don't miss it. All these thoughts, like, you still have them, but we're better at dealing with them. And then when you have good technique that's efficient, you can have those thoughts, but you switch on, you pick your target, you get absorbed in what you're doing, and you hit it, and you hit a decent shot. And when you hit a bad one, it's not that bad. So to me, the technique sort of takes care of the mental game, and then you build both up as you go, and you become an incredibly strong golfer. And I think that's what the best golfers in the world have. They still have thoughts. They still have negative thoughts and kind of like what everyone else does, but their game is built so strong that, you know, it weathers that. And it's stronger than the negativity.
Did you find it with confidence that you just sort of hit the ball harder and harder?
Yeah, well, that was what was great about my swing at that time, was what I was working on, was the harder I hit it. It was always a good feeling for me, is covering it with the right shoulder. And the harder I covered it, the straighter it went. The start line got straighter. And when I really did it, it held its line. And if I didn't quite do it enough, I'd just hit a little weak cut. Right. You know, but it's always on the green, always in play. Yeah. And so that, to have that feeling is so comforting on the course under any shot, on any situation.
Yeah. But here's the thing, though. It went again.
Yeah.
And was it different the second time around, or was it the same kind of thing?
Yeah, no, it was different. Well, it was the same driving. Driving has always been the issue. Mm. But I never quite got hold of it after the Dunhill. I was working with Rob Rock, but he was still playing. So it was really hard to do the work that I needed to do. We'd kind of done some work and pulled it back to a playable position, but it was the way we'd done it was maybe not ideal.
You could do worse than just swing like him, by the way.
Well, I mean, it'd be nice.
Economy of movement. Nothing moves that doesn't need to move.
But again, like, his swing is beautiful. It's flowing. It's very simple, but there's been hours and hours of technical tinkering that people don't always understand, and they like, he look at his swing, but like, there's thousands of hours gone into that tinkering in a mirror trying to figure things out. It went again, and
it's a bit less. It sounds like it was just the one thing, though, the second time around. From what you've said already, this here is that it was a whole bunch of things went wrong.
Well, I think initially, when back in like 2013, it was my driving, and then obviously just everything kind of gets dragged away because you start focusing on that. And this last 2017, when I really struggled, was my driving, but I kind of kept everything else in decent shape, not great, but decent. And that's why driving off the deck was just, it enabled me to, the faults in my swing, it countered them. So I could put my swing on it, not really have to think about it, and have a lot of confidence in hitting the fairway. But I always remember going down to Ned Bank in, it must have been around there, maybe 2019 it was, and driving off the deck, But obviously, when you're driving off the deck, it depends on the grass and how firm it is. Well, yeah. Nedbank gets really baked and firmed out. Well, on Sunday at Nedbank, Gary Player sat on the tee, and I've gone to knock up a little bit of dirt to put my driver on, and it's all sand, and there's no grass.
Right.
And I could, there was nothing. I was hit, I was literally hitting it out of sand.
Yeah.
And Gary Player sat 5 yards away at me, thinking, like, what is this guy doing? And I couldn't get a tee.
Yeah.
And I played awful on the Sunday, and that was like one moment. I think I played with Westy, and I drove it poorly. I was hitting these weak cuts all day because I just couldn't get a strike on it. And that was when I was like, well, look, this isn't going to cut it if I want to compete in these tournaments. Because I know that I can compete in them and I know I can win. And that's what's funny about the golf is like the Belfry the other week, you know, I'd not played well coming into that. But I felt so good. I genuinely thought that was mine, that I was going to win it. I just, you know, I didn't put very well on Sunday. But the shots I hit gave me a lot of confidence. So to feel like that, so at ease in that situation, I feel like there's a lot of good stuff happening. Just got to keep kind of putting it together and trying. I'm making too many mistakes at the moment, silly mistakes, you know, like little flyer over the green.
That's and usually, make that's usually a stepping stone to playing.
Yeah, well, but the golf is good. Like, yeah. You know, I'm in play, I'm lots of chances, making lots of birdies. So it's, you know, things are good, going in the right direction. So it's exciting, but underneath it all, I know that what I'm capable of, but there's been a hell of a journey to get to that stage. Hopefully it's going to be a little bit smoother for the rest of my career, yes. But we will see.
I'm not holding my breath anyway.
Well, no, I've given up trying to predict what's going to happen in my future. Exactly. But the journey continues.
Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda means less work and more play. Tough by name and by nature, this turf variety, supplied exclusively by Lawn Solutions Australia, is the perfect choice for your home lawn. With superior drought tolerance, speedy recovery and toughness, Tiff Tough really is the smart grass. For more information and to find your nearest accredited supplier, head to lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au.
Anyway, this is what I meant by we're kind of doing things in the wrong order. Let's go back to amateur days. You went to Augusta State.
Yeah.
What took you there, for one thing, and what made them offer you a scholarship? Where were you?
So this is funny.
I think before you played in the Walker Cup.
Yeah, so I was doing nicely. I was England international, under 16s, under 18s, got a scholarship. I think I played the Caris. And Jim Kelson, who was the manager, the coach there at the time, offered me a scholarship, and I was 16 maybe. I was like, going to America, that's a bit out there. Yeah. I'm not interested in that. So I said no. And then a few years later, my golf wasn't really going anywhere. I actually bumped into my geography teacher at the Belfry as well, he was my tutor, and I walked out of his class.
Really?
I said, I'm really sorry, but this is not helping my golf. I'm out of here. So that was an interesting conversation with mum and dad, but yeah, they supported me. And then I was a full-time amateur and things weren't going great. And I got a phone call from Adam Frain, who was a fellow England international, and he'd gone out to Augusta State. But his visa, there was a problem with his visa, and he came back and he wasn't going to take it up. So he said, look, there's a scholarship available. And I already had two friends on the team, Robert Duck and Jamie Elson. And at that the timing was perfect. So I was like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm all over that. I thought I was going to go and play at Augusta National. Like, I had no idea what was going on. I just thought I was going to Augusta and that was my home course.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you say
yes?
So I flew out in December, walked out onto Forest Hills putting green, and was like, oh, no, I've made a terrible mistake. The facilities were terrible and it wasn't good. And I'm like, well, what about Augusta National? Well, do we not practice there? And they said, well, we'll get to go once a year. I was like, oh, okay. But anyway, it turned out it was the best decision I'd ever made. The coach then was Jay Sewell. He took a big gamble on me. He saw my swing and brought Rob Duck and Jamie Elson into his office and said, is this guy for real? Like, is he actually any good? And they vouched for me, fortunately.
Right.
And I came and shot two. I didn't qualify for the first tournament. And he took a punt on me and I went and shot 266 as the first two rounds, and so he put him at ease. And from then on, I did really well and was a three-time All-American, and just completely opened my eyes to the golfing world, I guess. Like I said earlier, Jamie Elson was on my team. He was number one. I was kind of number two, and he was just doing everything a year ahead of me, and he was just somebody to shoot at and try and emulate.
Who were the guys you were competing against at that time?
Well, the thing about the American college system, it's fantastic, is it's competition every single day. Mm. So we had between 10 and 15 guys on the team for 4 years or 3 years. And every day you're competing, whether you're playing on the course, whether you're on the range, short game, putting, we'd always have a competition at the end of the practice. Whether it was for a sleeve of balls or to not have to run the golf course at night.
That's just to make your team, though. I mean, I'm talking about tournaments.
But then, so in the tournaments, so we had it was a strong. So DJ Trahan, Hunter Mahan, Bill Haas, Webb Simpson, Ricky Barnes, Lucas Glover, Eric Compton, Luke Donald, Paul Casey was there for my first year. And a bunch of other guys that Scott Jameson was there. There's quite a few others that I'm forgetting as well. It was strong. Yeah. It was a strong, it's always strong, yeah. But it was a strong era.
You found out how good you were then.
Yeah. Yeah. But you just learn to play. You learn to compete. Mm-hmm. And when I left there, I'd gone from, I actually gave up golf in college, funny enough.
Tell me more. Was there a woman involved in this?
There was a woman involved very shortly after that.
Right.
But I think maybe 2 years in, came back and I shot like 280s in the Welsh amateur, drove home, said, no, this isn't for me. I'm just not enjoying it, putting so much pressure on myself. And so I said, I'm going to go back to college, get my degree and figure something out. So I went back and started partying and met my wife.
At a party? And,
She lived in the development that I lived in. So, and she was homesick. And our coach brought us into the office one day and said,
where's
look,
she from?
She's from South Carolina, 2 hours away.
Not
from,
too far.
Yeah, 2 hours away from Augusta. And the coach said to us, look, Lauren's a bit homesick and she's really good at golf. First year on the team, can you look after her, make her feel a bit more at home? So I took that to heart and
sounds like it.
Made sure she was happy, and funny enough, she stopped going home every weekend. Yeah. So we had a lot of fun, and I won three times that fall, and I wasn't practicing that much, so it was like a bit of a lesson as well, which whenever I tell that story, people go, and so you're doing what you do now and you know what works. So, yeah. So two different things, but so then suddenly golf was like back on the table. I was ranked number one in the country for a little period, and it was just a natural progression. I got in the Walker Cup, had a really good Walker Cup and turned pro straight after.
You were just about the best player in that team, were you?
This
is at Ganton, 2003.
It was at Ganton, yeah. So I led GB and I out on the Sunday against Bill Haas, and we won, which was really good because our team was, if you look back at our team, I think there's only me and Stuart Manley that is still playing.
Gary Wilsonholm was in that team.
Yes. Yep, Gary was there. And the American team was strong.
Mm-hmm. Stuart Wilson is now going to be captain.
Stuart Wilson, Nigel Edwards. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good players, but just not maybe perceived to be as good.
Yeah.
But, you know, strong team and we beat them.
Yeah, I mean, I was there for that. And I must admit, I did look at it on paper and think,
yeah, paper,
you know,
we didn't
as
have
do,
a chance.
No chance here, you know, unless the weather's horrific. But, you know, good on you.
But, we did. It was a great week and just a bit of a catalyst to head off into your pro career. And I turned pro the following day, flew straight up to New York to see Mitchell Spearman, and we ripped my swing apart. And I took a few months off and rebuilt my swing. And then
he was Ledbetter's assistant.
He was. He was. He was a friend of my manager at the time, Rocky Hambrick. So it was a complete rebuild. I remember I was living in Augusta still, and going back, and I kept going in after like six or seven holes. I just couldn't get it around the course with what I was working on.
Was he at Lake Nona in Orlando at the time?
No, he was up in New York at I forgot the name of the course. Beautiful course. So I'd just fly up there and see him, and then. When I got my card the following year, he'd come out on tour a little bit, but yeah, we did a lot of work and kind of got things in a playable place, because I genuinely felt like, although I'd had a good amateur career, I wasn't capable of I thought I could get my card, but I didn't think I could keep it. And I needed to do the work, so that's what I did, and I went down that route for a few years. But it was just hard because Mitchell was in New York and I was playing in Europe, so I didn't get to see him very often. So that's basically why that ended after that period. But I'd done a lot of good work and then moved on to see Pete Cowan.
We've got to talk about the Ryder Cup. You played in the Ryder Cup in 2008, which is, I was going to say famous, but infamous might be more appropriate. The Nick Faldo captaincy, which has been written about a lot. I always give guys like yourself who were in that team a lot of credit, because it would have been awfully easy, given what we know was going on that week, to throw Nick Faldo completely under the bus. But apart from Sergio having a couple of pops at him, nobody's really done that. I mean, is this something you're comfortable talking about? Or, I mean, how do you look back on it now?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was obviously mistakes made. When you look back at the years leading up to it, what the Ryder Cup or the European Ryder Cup team had figured out, and what sort of building a blueprint that worked. And then after 2008, the successes that they had by building more vice captains, just understanding how to create the right environment. And our year, we kind of went completely against all that, which was a shame. But I think Nick was trying to do what he thought was best. Having Jose Maria in the team room was an amazing thing. He is the Ryder Cup, and when you needed some emotional speeches at night, he was there to carry that torch. But I think Nick tried to do his best. I actually genuinely do. I just don't think he was suited for the job personally. He's not really much of a man manager, and you've got different personalities on the team all kind of needing a little bit of something different. And I don't think he was able to give everyone that. So it was a bit of a shame. For me, and I think most of the guys, it was still an amazing week. It's an amazing week to be part of. It's still memories that I look back on regularly. And I'll never forget, the Valhalla clubhouse is set on a hill, and you walk down to the range and then down to the putting green and then down to the first tee, and you're just gradually working your way there, and the atmosphere that you could hear in the clubhouse before you even open the doors. It's just an amazing thing to be part of. The eyes of the world are watching, and you're right in the middle of it. So it's a special week. Nothing's going to change that. It would have just been nice to have won. If we could have won, it would have been amazing. And we put a good effort on Sunday to try and get back in the mix, but we fell quite a bit short in the end. But to be honest, I just think we obviously didn't play well enough as a team, but I don't think we got the pairings right. I think if the pairings had been different, I think it would have been a very different story.
Yeah, it's not that hard a thing to get right either.
I don't necessarily think so. Obviously, you can put two guys together that aren't suited and they can go and play fantastic. Everyone in the team is a great player. But you can enhance your chances. What you don't want is to put people together that have polar opposite games and don't think they should be playing together and are not comfortable playing. When you do that, that's not a good combination.
I've had Nicholas Kolsatz on this podcast, and he was talking about his Ryder Cup at Medina. And he played the first day in that famous game he played with Lee Westwood, when he shot, nothing and won on the last hole against Tiger. And then the next day, he was talking about he was in a car going to the course with Sergio, who he's going to be playing with, and they didn't know each other. They'd never even played together before that. And, crazy.
Yeah. I think that's what they've got dialed down now more. I think there's so much more effort is going into pairings months before.
Yeah.
And everybody knows who's an option and who isn't. But I don't know why it's taken so long.
It's not that difficult either.
Not really. I mean, you've got to kind of look at the golf ball. Foursomes, you've got to look at the golf ball. And then basically, who do you want to play with? Who do you not want to play with? Yeah. Who's going to make you the most comfortable out there?
Yeah.
And everyone's selfish, so everyone wants to play with the best players because
They
want a point. They want to get some points on the board and leave some history.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that complicated. But again, it comes back to communication and actually discussing it with each one of the players and like who's a no, who's a hard no, who do you want to play with?
Yeah.
But when you don't have those conversations, it's, you know, and you don't know the team that well, you know, it's going to be a bit of potluck. So, I think something now they've got dialed down pretty good. But I do think, I do look back and think if we'd have maybe had a chat, an open chat in the team room about pairings, I think it would have been very, very different. Obviously, everyone wants to play, so someone's got to make the call who's going to sit out. But I think the pairings would have been more in harmony, I think.
So how do you look back on it overall? I mean, is it a frustrating experience?
No, I wouldn't really say frustrating. I think
it's a great thing to have done.
It is what it is. It's something that, you know, not that many people get to experience. So I'm immensely proud of it. I'm proud of the fact that I qualified. I would never got a pick, so it's a good job I qualified.
Yeah. But, especially if he doesn't really know who you are.
Exactly. I look back on it. It is what it is. We didn't win, but I think it was an amazing week to spend in a team room on the course with guys that I'd looked up to. I use Westy as an example. You know, he's from my hometown. When I was an amateur, I caddied for him when I was 12, and he was the captain of the Notts Boys.
Really?
When he was 18, I think, or something like that. Yeah, something.
You share
like
the
that.
Nottingham Forest affliction.
Yeah.
As well,
so to be on the Ryder Cup team with someone like that I'd looked up to for so long, and obviously plenty of other guys on the team, and having Jose Miri and Nick as a captain, it's pretty special. It's something that is hard to put into words, and you become closer with them. And I guess that sort of leading on to what's happened now, it's a bit of a shame that things are a little bit more separated. I look back on that and think it's a fond memory, and I'd love to qualify for another one and have another go with the things, how things have moved on and the teams are picked and pairings are picked and just everything that goes into it now. It's more of a united front, I think, than ever before. So it'd be very cool to experience that, and obviously win as well would be amazing.
Have you still got some of the gear in a cupboard somewhere?
I do, yeah. I've got some flags and my uniforms, a few gifts from the week.
You can never wear it again, though.
I know, it's funny like that. I think there was a blue shirt, I can't remember what day it was. It might have been the Saturday, but I've had that hanging in my wardrobe since then, and it's never come off the hanger.
No.
All it's done is moved houses.
Yeah.
It's been sat there. I'm like, what am I doing with this?
Where can you wear it? You know.
But, you know, it means something. It means a lot. You know, it's a little trophy in itself to mark something that you've achieved throughout your career, and coming up to 20 years as a pro now. So it's a nice little memento from that period.
Is it true that everyone talks about there's three levels of pressure in pro golf? You know, there's tournament pressure, there's major championship pressure, and then there's Ryder Cup pressure. Was that right? Can you remember what that was like, standing first tee?
Yeah, well, so my memories of it were, it starts from after qualifying, and Westy called me a few days after qualifying and said, look, here's the deal. This is what it's going to be like.
What did he say?
I can't remember the exact words, but he basically said it's like nothing else that you've ever experienced on the first tee. So after chatting to him, I was like, right, I'm going to build this first tee up in my head to be the most horrible experience. Like, it can't be any worse.
Yeah.
So when I get there, it can't be as bad as I think. And I actually did a really good job of it, because I got on that tee and whilst I was nervous, my first tee shot was with Henrik in the foursomes, and I took the first tee shot, and you know, your hairs are standing up, and it's almost got that scary now, and everyone knows it. It's almost gone over the edge.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't matter. No one cares.
Well, you just stand up and hit it. People will understand.
Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, nerves got to him. Yeah. And then you crack on. But at that time, I think obviously you don't want to do that. And I almost enjoyed it. It was immense. Like, I don't think there's been any time I've ever felt what I felt on that first tee. And I nutted one down the middle, and that was a nice feeling to walk off and feel like you've done exactly what you're meant to do. But it's just the energy in the air. Like, I mean, and now it's even bigger. The crowds, you know, around the first tee, what they're doing, it's even bigger than what they had at Valhalla. I think they only had two stands at Valhalla. So one side of the tee was completely open. And, you know, those days are long gone.
France was incredible.
Yeah. So, it is a different pressure. But it's one of those things where it comes down to confidence. If you've qualified for the Ryder Cup team, you're playing well. So when you're playing well, you thrive in those environments. And even being in the States and then, you know, the fans all chanting USA, it's just energy. And you can use that energy and feed off it. It doesn't really matter what the content of what they're saying. It's just, you know, you can use it. But if you've qualified for the team or been picked and you've not been playing well, but you've been picked because you're a certain level of player that you think can enhance. And I've spoke to David Howell quite a lot about this, because he was in those situations where he'd qualified really early and then was playing poorly and struggling with his game. And I would not want to be in that environment. If you're not confident and you're not comfortable with your game and you're struggling, it would be a horrible environment to try and be playing in, because of the pressure. It's, you know, every single shot. But I think when you get to that level, you're just so into it and you know that you can do it. So it's no issue.
What was your experience like with the crowd?
It was pretty good. Like, I remember them chanting pretty hard. I remember a bunch of people getting thrown out. But it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't aggressive. It was just,
yeah,
maybe they just went over the edge a little bit.
I've been to multiple Ryder Cups in America, and I don't remember that one being particularly bad. You might be right, but I was at Brookline.
Well, I mean, Valhalla was, it's nothing like, Medina, it's nothing was, like New York.
Medina was terrible as well.
Northeast US is a different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
Valhalla was, it was loud, and okay. Obviously it heavily against us.
Yeah.
But it was fine,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah.
From what I gather from Brooklyn and other, well, even when you go and play majors in New York, you know, the grief that you get, they just love it. They just love giving it out.
I do worry about Beth Page.
Yeah, I think that could be an issue. Yeah, I think that could definitely be a problem. But, and because they thrive on it and they know that, so the locals are like, well, let's make it even worse. And it's just building up. So who knows? I mean, hopefully it won't be. But the crowd was amazing. I mean, obviously all against you, but...
So no
it heckling. Doesn't matter. Yeah, so there was heckling, but yeah,
I've spoken to, you know,
there was no one going over the edge where you were over your shot and then shouting out on your backswing or anything like
no,
that.
No,
it was just during the
I mean, I've spoken to one player who shall remain nameless because I don't think he would want it to be out there, but he played at Medina, which narrows it down to 12. But and he said he was heckled on every single full shot he hit.
Oh, really?
Every single one.
Yeah, no, we had none of that. There was none of that. It was all good. All good. It, you know, just like the home advantage.
Well, maybe just because you were losing as well. Maybe that helped.
Maybe it helped, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, nobody knew who I was at the time, so it's
well,
fine.
That's right, even the captain. Yeah, that's right. So since then, I mean, the Ryder Cup, I know you've done a wee bit of radio work at the Open with Radio 5 Live.
Yeah, and the Ryder Cup.
And the Ryder Cup. I mean, what was it like on that side of the...
Terrible. Well, no, that's not
because it must have been difficult right. Having been.
Yeah, it was difficult, but at the same time, it was good to see it from a different point of view. And the guys that I was working with, I really enjoyed doing it with. I did a lot with Ian Carter, who's fantastic.
He's very good.
But it's a different experience. And I think the first time I did it was 2010 in Wales, and I was so bored I got lost on the course. I missed a hole out
right.
As I was watching my group. I was waiting for my group and I missed the par 3, 13, is it? 10, 13. Yeah, I completely missed it, and I was waiting for my group. I'm like, where are they? And I'd realised they were still back there. So it's different, you know. When you're there, it's like, oh, it'd be nice to go and do that and commentate. But because it's radio, you're not like on all the time. So it's just they're going to come to you just a little bit here and there. So it's a little bit boring at times, but it's also fun to see it from that point of view. And especially when you get the good groups and it's all happening, it's kind of fun.
There's nothing better. I mean, to be honest, I don't really care who wins, but I want it to be close, because there is nothing better to watch than when it's close. And we haven't had a close one since Medina.
True.
There have been runaways, you know, and there's a danger in that. I mean, people could lose interest, because it's not that much fun to watch when it's clear who's going to win.
No, I mean, the Sundays are certainly incredible to watch when it's right on the edge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And if that doesn't happen, then it is a shame. But it kind of goes in cycles, though, as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be close this time. I mean, both teams look pretty good.
Yeah, it'll be interesting in Italy, because the course is not that great.
No. But then, when was the last time?
I think it's exciting.
It was 1981, the last time European Ryder Cup was in Europe was played on a decent golf course.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been some real mints since then. You
know. Yeah, I mean, Paris was good. But then Paris that they play the Ryder Cup on wasn't Paris that we know.
No.
Which is a shame. You know, they've made it a lot easier.
I mean, it's all right, but it's not great.
But the thing that with Paris National, the thing that used to be amazing about there is most tee shots were scary, because the rough was proper thick. And if you're in there, it's pretty much lost ball. So it's like really hard and stressful. But obviously for Ryder Cup, they ripped all that out for spectators. So suddenly when we went back and played the French Open, it's like, well, this is a lot easier. It's still intimidating in places, but not like all 18 holes. Yeah. So it's a bit of a shame. But I guess that's the nature of the beast. It kind of has to adapt. But
so what do you make of the course this year then? What's your verdict?
I think we're going to win, because we're going to bore the US team to death on the course.
Right.
I think they're going to be so flat when they see it.
Elaborate.
I just think they're going to be flat when they see it. And we're like, this is not kind of what I was expecting. Maybe that's a little bit harsh. But
explain that a bit more. I've never been, so I've only seen it.
Look, the course is okay. It's all right.
Yeah.
But it's to have a blank canvas and come up with that, I think, is a little bit disappointing. It's just not inspiring. There's some really bad holes on it. Mm. There's some good holes. And I think the back nine will be exciting in match play format.
People see
with that. The setup. And I actually think it could be really, really exciting, the last few holes. But as a course that you're playing, it's just not like, you don't stand on a hole and go, oh, wow, this is an incredible hole. Mm. There's some tough shots, don't get me wrong, but it's just not exciting to play. Like, there's a lot of courses we play on tour that you're like excited to go and play. And when you get there, it's like, yeah, the condition's amazing, the courses are great. That is not one of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, it's a different animal for the Ryder Cup. So the way it'll be set up, I'm sure it'll be fine. But it is a bit more Americanish. So they're going to have to do some tweaking to set it up, I think. I'm sure they'll do the normal, slow the greens down, soften them up a little bit, and which is a shame, but kind of, you know, it's a big deal. Yes, and you have that option.
And I think it's certainly
grow the rough up.
It's maybe more important that for the European Tour that they win this time.
I think it would be a big deal. Yeah, we need to win this one. And I think obviously we're going to be underdogs on paper, but we're going to have a strong team.
It's always the case.
And if you're in the top 12 guys in Europe or America, you're capable of beating every one of them given day.
I think I've said this on these podcasts before, but I mean, the formula for winning, it's not that complicated. I mean, if the top three players in the Rory, Rahm and Hovland all play well and win 3.5-4 points out of five, Europe will win.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
I mean, the real pressure on the best players in the team.
Yeah.
If they perform, you know, again, I think I've mentioned this before, but look at the last one where it was an absolute, on paper, look, the big walkover. Saturday night, there was a 6-point difference between the Americans and the European team. Rory had played three and lost three. Rory plays three and wins three, it's tied.
Yeah.
It's a very fine margins in these things.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, like you say, the top players have a lot of pressure on them because they know they have to go win. Mm. And it's also psychological. If you go and take Rory out or John Rahm out, it's like it's a big deal. It's almost more than a point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a changing of the team, right, this year. It's going to be a very different team to what we're used to, and the shaping of the team for years to come as well. So new blood coming into it, younger guys that are pretty excited and feeling invincible. So
somebody from Poland in the team.
Yeah, well, pretty sure, yeah. You know, home advantage, trying to make a mark. With a bit more experience around that course. And I would say one thing, I think that course, you do need a bit more experience. It's a quite a fiddly course. And at that time of year, probably conditions-wise will be maybe a little bit of wind, bit of warmth, but it's tricky. You know, there's a lot of elevation change,
yeah,
up and down, with wind, and the fairways are tight. And that we, as we know, they're going to grow the rough up. So it'll be ball striking will be a key. So yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm looking forward to it.
Right. Inevitably, here it comes. We're going to finish up with the Live Golf. What do you make of it all? Where are we headed? What's going on? What's going to happen? You know.
Well, that's easy. No one has a clue. Nobody has an answer in the world of golf, no matter who you speak to. Everyone's got an opinion, but no one knows actually what's going
to
happen.
Well, what would you like to see happen then?
Well, so what I would like to see happen is the whole golfing landscape brought together. And, you know, sitting at the top would be PGA Tour and Live of some sort, that both can kind of sit up there where if you're in the top, whatever it is going to be, 40, 50, 60 players, you make a ton of money and you play a schedule of 20, 22, 24 events. But it has to be, you know, both are going to have to give. And I'm not sure both are going to want to give for this to happen. So there's got to be something. What they end up doing there, whether elevated events become some form of Live and Live gets sucked into PGA Tour and it just becomes a new thing, I really don't know. Don't know how that would work.
See, I would blow up the whole thing, and I would contract the players.
Well, that's one thing that has to. I've never understood why. I know this independent contractor thing, but who cares? Like, we cannot guarantee. Yeah. We can't put on tournaments if the sponsors don't know who's going to play.
Exactly.
When you go and have meetings with tournaments and sponsors, and you say their first question is, "Well, who's going to come and play?" And the tour, certainly in our case, the DP World Tour. They can't. Well, we have no idea.
I mean, look at the field last week.
There we do not know who
one guy in the top 50 in the world playing last week.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. So I think everyone should have to play. But I think if you can bring all the tours in the world together, so it's one ranking system, and you just climb up it, isn't it more like the tennis model? Yeah.
And I don't think you need world rankings. I just throw them away. Who cares?
Well, if everything's working together, I think you can have one system, bring Australia. Australia brings so much to golf, yet it's so underutilized. Now, I know it's, you know, a long way and money and stuff, but what they have, golf course and in events, are fantastic. Bring them in, Asia, Japan, South Africa, and all the other tours all together, and the funding drips down, and you just have different levels of playing. And you can maybe keep it a bit more regionalized, and then you just keep qualifying, you keep going up. But there has to be one route. The greatest thing about golf is, until Live came on, is that nobody can stop you. It's not about who you know, who your dad is, how much money you've got. It's about is how good are you at golf. And as long as you can afford entry fee for Q School somewhere, there's a route to be in, becoming the world number one in the world. World number one. And that has to stay. You cannot stop that. And Liv has come along and it's like, well, what are you bringing to the table? Do the captains like you? It doesn't matter how good you are. If you're not liked, you're not getting a spot on the team. And that can't happen in professional golf. I know it happens in other sports, but it can't happen in golf. And that's the best thing we have. So we have to protect that and have all the tours coming together. And whether that means... we need it to be so if you have everyone on the same order of merit, if you like, and everyone's contracted to play a certain amount of events, and then everyone should have to play maybe in their home country if there's an event.
You don't want, I mean, everybody talks about how it's great that they'll get the best players playing against each other more often, But only up to a point. You don't want that every week.
No.
Because you don't want anything the same every week. I mean, if you had them under contract, you'd say, right, six of you are going here and six of you are going there. You could spread the word.
But the problem with that is I just don't think the top guys will let it go because they don't want to travel. And I can understand that. You know, I've been traveling for nearly 20 years now, and it's the last thing I want to do. If I could play in one country and just travel around hour, 2 hours,
they'd be
three
doing
hour
it less
flight.
Often. You know, as you said, they'd be only, well, say they did it 20 times a year.
Well, but the top guys only play 23 events anyway.
Yeah.
So they're still doing it quite a lot. And if you start making them fly to Australia, to Japan, to Asia, to Africa, to Europe, to America, like, it's a lot of travel. And it's not good for you. And it's not fun. And people don't want to do it. And it, certainly when you're at the top of the game and the money that the guys are making, they don't need to do it. No. So it's going to be really hard to get that passed. But I think if you can have some form of system where LIV becomes, maybe even have the PGA Tour is like, you know, January through September or August, and then LIV kind of takes over with these elevated fun events at the end of the year.
I would get rid of them. I think I don't care about them because I have no interest in them. The team thing might be what actually, ironically, lives on. You maybe have a month where there's a team thing with everybody playing in it.
Yeah, well,
you know, that would be fun.
Idea I've heard floated is basically once the season's finished on PGA Tour in August, basically then you have like an IPL and everyone can enter, everyone can put their names forward, and then whoever gets bought, if the top guys don't want to play, they don't have to play.
Yeah.
But the amount of money that would be involved in it, they probably would end up playing.
Hmm.
Which I think is probably a good way of doing it, and then it becomes a bit different, a bit more fun, more team aspect.
Where does the European Tour fit in all this?
Well, I suspect it would be sort of as it is now, just sat below the PGA Tour.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as it's all on one...
It'd be a promotion relegation thing. Yeah.
So you could play really well and you get your card for next year. You know, you move up and you might still get into some PGA Tour events that as they drop down.
Mm.
You know, the details are tricky. There's so many things to go into it.
Yeah.
But I think that's where it needs to go. And we have an opportunity as in worldwide golf to bring it all together and make it a fantastic system. And I hope that that doesn't get pushed aside. But my worry is that the agreement as it stands right now is not going to happen.
Well,
it's going to get, it's, both sides are not going to be able to agree and they'll go separate ways, and then it's going to be...
It may not fly in America legally.
Right? Exactly. So you've got that issue, but also you've got, you know, they've only got a limited amount of time to decide on what is going to happen. And I just don't know if LIV are going to give anything, concede anything, and I don't know if PGA Tour are.
Well,
and if they don't, you're left back to square one, and actually you're even worse.
They're going to get what they want. They're putting all the money in. I mean,
well, exactly.
I don't care what they're saying publicly about who's got position.
Yeah.
If you're putting the money in, you're going to get what you want.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things to be figured out. What would be nice to know is what Keith Pelley and Jay Monahan actually have as their vision, because that's not been shared with us.
No.
And that's what we need to get right. That's where the players need to be involved in, to have a say and bring some ideas to the table, and so that everybody who's in world golf can contribute to trying to get this right. But I also appreciate there's a lot of opinions that are going to go into that. But it just has to be done for the right way. We've got now suddenly got the money. The money's not going away. The money's going to be there in golf some way. We might as well make the most of it and build something that is going to stand the test of time and make it the fairest system to get the best players through to the very top.
We do seem to have moved on from the moral aspect of this, don't we?
It's funny how that works, huh?
Yeah, money talks very loudly. Yeah. Anyway, on that happy note, I think I'm very conscious that we've talked for over an hour. Ollie Wilson, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Oogie. Enjoyed it.
Well, if it's a warts and all look behind the scenes of professional golf that you're into, then I suspect you'll have enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Ollie and John Huggan for taking the time. Well, that's it for our Ryder Cup-themed episodes, but I hope you followed the podcast, because on our next, we'll get the inside story from one of the game's most recognisable voices.
So my television career was probably the exact opposite. of my playing career, right, expectation-wise, when I started.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea.
That's former player turned TV commentator Gary Koch, next time on The Thing About Golf.